Ragtime to Rock and Roll. In this week's episode, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf?, Kenneth Moore examines the first hit song to come from the Walt Disney Studios and talks of the early success of the Boswell sisters and Al Bowley. He also celebrates Gracie Field's most successful song and goes back to a time when Stanley Holloway's Bloody Tar was considered slightly risque.
For a great many people today, the year 1932 begins to take on just a faint look of modern times, because by now the world is moving into alignments that we're still familiar with today. In America, a frail-looking character called Franklin Roosevelt was on the brink of the presidency, and in Germany, a Mr. Schickelgruber was also within a pace or two of absolute power. Artistically, too, the pattern of performance and exploitation were taking on the forms that would apply right down to the moment nearly 8 years later when the said Mr. Schickelgruber's horror show took over. By 1932, the public was conditioned to accept broadcasting, gramophone records, and talking pictures. And as the Great Depression continued to depress people, and unemployment figures rocketed in Britain and America, the songwriter was faced with two choices: either to reflect hard times in his music, or to provide people with an escape from the hard times. To be frank about it, both schools flourished. The socially conscious songs may have been few and far between, but when they arrived, they made their point, especially with regard to songs about returning war heroes who were ending up on the breadline.
Remember my forgotten man? You put a rifle in his hand. You sent him far away. You shouted, hip hooray. But look at him today. Remember my forgotten man. You had him cultivate the land. He walked behind a plow. The sweat fell from his brow. But look at him right now. And once he used to love me. I was happy then. He used to take care of me. Won't you bring him back again? 'Cause ever since the world began, a woman's got to have a man. Forgetting him, you see, means you're forgetting me. Like my forgotten man.
My Forgotten Man, sung there by Joan Blondell, came from a musical called Gold Diggers of 1933, one of the key talking pictures of the whole decade, of which more in a moment. But before we look into the implications of the Gold Diggers, what about the other school of songwriting thought? The one that felt that social consciousness was no subject for popular music. One of the big successes at this point in time was a ballad by a British writer, Ray Noble, who was in no doubt at all what the function of the composer was.
The whole point of songwriting then was that people knew about the social comment. When it came to songs, they were trying to get away from it. They didn't want to know anything about social comment. Songs were for relaxation. And listening to popular songs is a form. You call it escape. It's a relaxation for the mind. It's not a means of introducing the mind to what's going on in the world. This is a different thing entirely.
Well, Ray Noble certainly didn't write a protest song with Love is the Sweetest Thing. The song became associated with one of the most remarkable crooners in British history, Al Bowley, as Noble admits.
He, of course, was very much a character, and he fell into New York life. Well, of course, Al was a very well-traveled man anyway. He'd been half around the world. He was a great sports lover. He used to go to all kinds of sporting events and so forth. And the only thing with Al was that he was one of these rather simple chaps. A fella was the nicest guy in the world, in which case he promptly emptied his pockets if the fella needed money. And I've seen him do it. He could have anything. You'd give him the shirt off his back, you know. Or he was the dirtiest scoundrel unhung, in which case Al could rip him in part. And he could. He was an extremely strong man. It was either black or white with him. There were no greys. He was an interesting character. He laid a trail of female destruction across the United States, which I don't think has ever been beaten.
Love is the sweetest thing. What else on earth could ever be? Such happiness to everything. As love knows glory.
Bowley singing with Ray Noble's orchestra, Love is the Sweetest Thing, and so were the royalties that accrued to composer Noble. As a general rule, Noble's theory about escapist music was a valid one, and even the songwriting team which wrote My Forgotten Man would have agreed with it for the most part. That team was a very remarkable one, composed of musician Harry Warren and lyricist Al Dubin, and Warren and Dubin were, to the Hollywood musical of those days, what Rodgers and Hart, or the Gershwin brothers, were to the Broadway show. With two 1932 productions to their credit, 42nd Street and the first of the Gold Diggers series, Dubin and Warren made world famous a new style movie fairy story. The backstage musical where the obscure chorus girl gets pushed onto the stage on opening night as the producer says to her, you're going to go out there, and when you're going to come back, you're going to be a star. The reality was not quite so romantic, as Harry Warren remembers the status of the songwriter in Hollywood.
I think they thought of it on the studio lots as the lowest form of art. The songwriters were absolutely ignored at the time on studio lots. But if a guy came from New York that had just done the show, he was supposed to be somebody. And he could be a songwriter. That's what impressed them. Some of these producers were impressed by fellows that went to college, who spoke very good English, you know. And analyzed a script and double talk, and they thought it was great. And Buzz Berkeley said to the head of the studio, when he asked him, how are you going to do this number, Buzz? And he'd give him a double talk. He said, well, you see, we're going this way. Now the girls over there, and we zoom in and over there. Then we move over here, we break out and show everything. And he keeps on doing all this double talk. And I say, when he's all through, he said, how much is it going to cost? That's the whole history of making pictures. What's it going to cost?
And his orchestra, In the Money. The words of that song are graceful enough, but the man who wrote them, Al Dubin, appears to have been anything but graceful. He and his partner, Harry Warren, started pouring out hits from the moment they got to the West Coast, and Warren has given us a most vivid word portrait of Dubin.
He was a 6'3" or 6'4", big husky, weighed 300 and some pounds, and he ate like Henry VIII. He loved to eat. He could eat two steaks at one sitting. While he was eating a steak, he'd ask the chef to make him another one. It was nothing for him to eat two steaks. He could drink a whole case of Coca-Cola. But he used to go, he loved faraway places, too. He had a black chauffeur. And the black chauffeur had a uniform, wore a uniform, off-red uniform. You can imagine what he looked like. And he loved to go down to these Mexican border towns down here. And one time when he was down there, we were in trouble at the studio, and they were trying to get him. We couldn't find him. We finally traced him because he had a habit of oaring in big portions, you know, so they would remember him. So I said, well, you come right back. They need the lyric to this melody. He says, I've got the lyric. He says, get a pencil and paper.
In the shadows that become and sing to you, let me dream a song that I can bring to you. Take me in your arms and let me cling to you. Let me linger on. Let me live my song. In the winter, let me bring the spring to you. Let me feel that I mean everything.
Sometimes writers like Warren and Dubin got their ideas from the scenario, sometimes from the personality of the stars. But there were other ways that successful songs came to be written. For instance, Keeping Your Eyes and Ears Open. Warren explains.
We had a gal that on the Warren a lot. We used to kid her a lot about some guy she was going with. And she was real southern. She had a southern accent, you know. And he said to her, why do you go around with that guy all the time? And she says, I don't know. I guess he's getting to be a habit. You know, and that's how we wrote He's Getting to Be a Habit with me.
Let me stay in your arms. I'm addicted to your charms. You're getting to be a habit with me.
I used to think your love was something that I could take or leave alone.
But now I couldn't do without my supply. I need you.
I can't break away. I must have you every day, as regularly as coffee or tea.
You got me in your clutches and I can't get free. You're getting to be a habit with me.
Can't break it. You're getting to be a habit with me. I wouldn't break it if I could. You're getting to be a habit with me.
I don't really definitely think you're sure.
You're getting to be a habit with me.
Dinah Shore and Tony Martin, Getting in the Habit. Now, while writers like Dubin and Warren were turning out hit songs just like that for the movie business, the great New York names were just as busy doing the same thing for Broadway. As a matter of fact, 1932 was the last time that Fred Astaire would be thought of as a musical comedy star. Soon he, too, was to become part of the Hollywood Dream Factory. But in 1932, he was still tapping it out on the Great White Way, giving the kind of performance that made him every songwriter's favorite singer. Not perhaps the best singer, but the favorite. When he starred in Cole Porter's The Gay Divorcee in 1932, Porter went into raptures over the Astaire singing style. And fellow composer Johnny Green explains why, with Astaire's own view of it to follow.
Easy to see Fred Astaire walking down the street. That's already a theatrical performance, unique unto him. Just the way he moves, the way he walks, the way he uses his hands, everything about him. And it's a very pleasant voice. He's the most musical person that ever was. His paws have musicality, you know. And he reads a lyric and he senses the relationship between a melodic line and a lyric and the integration of each with the other in a way that nobody else does, really. And he has no interest whatever in being the composer. He's only interested in being the interpreter. This is one of the malaise, one of the diseases of the last 30 years. The singers who are frustrated composers, they're going to do it better than Cole Porter did it. They're going to improve on Cole Porter's lyric with dropping in those added prepositions and conjunctions. If Cole Porter had wanted those ands and bits and buts and ifs, he'd have put them there. And I'll guarantee, without mentioning any names, including the biggest singers of our time, that Fred Astaire has never done that to any song.
My reaction to Night and Day, I just didn't know what it was, because it was long, and, well, when you hear any music the first time, you can't get it all in, but that one particularly was a difficult one to get with, because I was constantly wondering how I would be able to sing it. I had the feeling that it was a very good song, you know, because of what it said and the way it talked about night and day, so love and all that kind of business. But the melody is what I was wondering whether or not I could handle. And there were some parts of it that weren't too easy to get. But when I got to working on it, then is when I thought it was a really good song. And then, of course, that song became, I think, the reason for the success of the show. We were known as the show that has Night and Day in it.
Like the beat, beat, beat of the tom-tom, when the jungle shadows fall, like the tick tick tock of the stately clock as it stands against the wall. Like the drip 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 of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you, 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 night and day. You are the one. Only you beneath the moon and under the sun. Whether near to me or far, it's no matter, darling, where you are, I think of you. Night and day, day and night, why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever I go? In the roaring traffic's boom, in the silence of my lonely room, I think of you. Night and day, night and day, under the hide of me, there's an oh such a hungry yearning burning inside of me. And its torments won't be through till you let me spend my life making love to you day and night, night and day.
Fred Astaire singing one of Cole Porter's greatest songs, Night and Day. And you couldn't really get much more escapist than that. But what about those hit songs that you could take either way, as downright social preaching or downright evasion? In 1933, a most freakish example of this turned up when a Hollywood artist called Walt Disney, already riding the tide of the Mickey Mouse industry, came up with an animated cartoon called The Three Little Pigs. And ever since then, the musicologists have been arguing whether the song that the three little pigs sang was an innocuous escapist jingle for tiny tots, or a shout of defiance at the gathering storms of unemployment, rearmament, breadlines, and dictators with no more territorial ambitions. Well, what do you think?
I built my house of straw, they built my house of hay. I took my flute, I don't give a hoot, and play around all day.
To sing and dance, work and play don't mix.
Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, according to Disney and Henry Hall. But who was the wolf? Our four-legged friend from the nursery rhymes, or the wolf at the door of half the homes in the Western world? Perhaps it doesn't matter. All that mattered to the Disney studios at the time was that the song became a vast hit over here as well as in America. The British by now were very nearly a colony of the United States, so far as popular songs were concerned. We had nothing comparable to the American movie industry. But sometimes we did turn up with a song that was widely popular, even if its appeal was strictly local. For instance, this next song, and the story that goes with it. It couldn't have meant much to a Texas oil tycoon or a New York shop girl, come to that. Stanley Holloway reminisces about a songwriting team called Lee and Weston, and the very peculiar, very eccentric, and very British song they supplied him with.
Darling Bob Weston was stone deaf, you know. Poor Bob. But he and Bert Lee used to meet every morning, regularly, and sit and talk. Bob would give his ideas, and Bert Lee would put in what he called the tried and trusted gags, you see. It was old Bert that thought of, you know, gags like, how do you spell tonsil? Oh, same as tonsil with a K, you know, and all that. So Bob used to ring me up. He could hear on the many people who are deaf can hear on the telephone. He used to ring me up, and one day the phone went. He said, "Is that you, Stan?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Bob West." I said, "Hello, Bob." He said, "I've got a number, I think, to suit you." I said, "Good." He said, "When would you like to hear it?" I said, "In time you like." He said, "Today?" I said, "Yes." And at that time I was in the show with Harry Pepper's White Coons. So this particular week, Harry said, what song are you going to sing this week? I said, this one. So he put the music up and played it, and I sang it. And he stopped after I said, "He walks the bloody tower." Oh, he said, "You can't do that." I said, "Why not?" He said, "You couldn't sing that over the air." Well, I said, "Why didn't you? Why not?" He said, "Well, you can't say bloody over the air." And, so we called down Roy Eckert, he was a director of programs. He came down from the top of the, he was at the top of it. And he went in the control room, and Harry said, "Sing it again to Roxy." I went straight to the microphone and sang it perfectly straight. When I finished it, I went in the control room, and I said, "What do you think, Roy?" He said, "Well," he said, "what do you think?" I said, "I think you should go over." I said, "I'm not using an adjective, I'm using a proper noun. You might say the Albert Hall, the Tower of London, the Bloody Tower, they're all proper nouns." I said, "You may have some people to take exception, but you've got a perfect answer, therefore you've got perfect publicity." He said, "Right, let it go." And of course it was a wonderful success. They loved it, because they'd never heard that done over the air. And of course, done with a sort of northern flavour. "She walks the bloody tower." It was gentle. But when the band boys started to do it, "She walks the bloody tower," you see, and then they stopped it. Because it didn't sound quite the same. The BBC stopped the band doing it. I remember a man wrote me a postcard, said, "Brothers," he said, "I haven't laughed much since my wife broke her leg."
In the Tower of London, large as life, the ghost of Anne Boleyn walks, they declare. For Anne Boleyn was once King Henry's wife, until he made the headsman bob her hair. Ah, yes, he did a wrong long years ago, and she comes up at night to tell him so. Where the head jumped underneath her arm, she walks the bloody tower. With the head tucked underneath her arm at the midnight hour. One night she caught King Henry, he was in the canteen bar. Said he, "Are you Jane Seymour, Anne Boleyn, or Catherine Parr? For how the sweet and fairy Anne, do I know who you are? With your head tucked under London in your arms.
Dear old Stanley Holloway, with a bit of English architectural history. Of course, Stanley was, and still is, one of those singers whose background and training make him independent of newfangled inventions like the microphone and amplification. But the truth is that in Britain in the early 1930s, there weren't many people who even grasped the significance of electronic aids to singing, at least if one of our witnesses can be believed. By 1933, one of the most popular recording groups was the Boswell sisters, and their lead singer, Connie Boswell, has a really extraordinary tale to tell about how the London Palladium acquired its first amplifying equipment.
Now we go to Europe and we play the Palladium in 1933. We took our own mic set. They did not use a microphone in the Palladium or any other theater in 1933. And we brought our own technician, our microphones, and everything. The funny part is when we left England, they asked us if they could keep the set that we had. And that was the first microphone and the speaker system that went in the Palladium was our set.
When I take my sugar to tea, all the boys are jealous of me. 'Cause I never take her where the gang goes. When I take my sugar to tea, I'm a rowdy, dowdy, that's me. She's a high-hat baby, that's she. So I never take her where the gang goes. When I take my sugar to tea, every Sunday afternoon, we forget about our cares, rubbing elbows at the wrist with those millionaires. When I take my sugar to tea, I'm as rich there as I can be. 'Cause I never take her where the gang goes when I take my sugar to tea.
When Connie Boswell and her sisters got back home from England, minus their microphones in 1933, what did they find? An America profoundly altered from the one they'd left, because one of the first actions of the new president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, was to repeal one of the daftest pieces of legislation in modern history. He did away with prohibition. Before 1933, Americans loved to get drunk in defiance of the law. From now on, it was quite different. Americans loved to get drunk within the law. And with the passing of Prohibition, passed also a whole era of tough music, sponsored by the gangsters who controlled the drink supply. There were thousands of jazz musicians like Joe Masala who remembered the whole thing with considerable affection.
In most cases, in those days, when you worked in a place that was selling liquor, you were usually working for some of the boys. A lot of times they were there, and a lot of times they weren't there, except that every now and then you noticed sort of hard-looking characters around the place. As a matter of fact, this Cass Club was a favorite hangout of Texas Guinan. And she used to love a song called the Basin Street Blues. And she'd like to have us play it. And she paid us $1 a chorus. And when we finished playing it, if we told her we played 50 choruses, she'd give us $50. Tips in Prohibition days were more than the job was worth. For instance, I played in a job, and in the band were Wingy Minone, Jack Teagarden, Pepe Benitez on guitar, Dave Tough on drums. And we only got $30 a week and a bottle of gin a night. That was our pay. So in order to add to that, we used to go to the tables and play tunes. For instance, Teagarden would go out with the trombone, and he'd come back with a fistful of money and drop it in the kitty, and then Wingy would go out and sing a couple of songs. This is the way we made our money. Except for the bad booze, it was a good time, because the booze wasn't too good, really.
And an ugly gal can do.
When singer-musicians like Jack Teagarden stopped working for the mobsters who operated illegal liquor, some of them went into Broadway pit orchestras, some into dance bands, and some into the touring companies. Jack's trumpet-playing brother Charlie joined Jack for a time in the comforting ranks of the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, a group as elephantine as the silhouette of its leader, and perhaps this was the most secure job in the whole of the American music business for a working musician.
This is a man that was completely out all by himself. He had so much class and personality. He kind of reminds you of the way Frank Sinatra is today. Just walk into a room and the whole place just lights up. And Paul had the same kind of personality. Paul insisted on paying more money than any other band. He would never hear of anybody paying a sideman more salary than he would. The minute he heard that maybe Fred Waring might hire somebody and pay him X amount of dollars a week, Paul would hear about it and say, everybody gets a raise. Fred Waring's not going to cut me, you know, one of these things. So, very, very generous man. We had the best musicians in the business all the years I was with Paul. Of course, he could hire anybody. And, we always traveled in our own private Pullmans. We had our own private diner. We had our own private baggage cars. We didn't traveled on buses or anything like that. If we couldn't hook onto a train going to our next engagement, we had a private train. We'd have our own engine to take us there. And it was the only man that operated that way that I ever worked with. You know, when you got through with a job, all you had to do was just put your horn down on the stand, just leave your music right where it was, and just get up and walk off. And when you got to the next engagement, wherever or whatever it might be, and you'd walk up on the stand, your instrument would be laying there, the book would be open right where you left it, and you never had to touch a thing. Nobody had to do anything except just sit there and play. That's all you had to do.
Teagarden singing and playing trombone. One of the things about Paul Whiteman that Charlie Teagarden didn't mention was his tireless search for new attractions, unknown talent. After all, it was Whiteman who first gave Crosby his chance, and in 1932 he hired a new singer, who, as it happens, never made it as big as Bing in the vocal stakes, but went on to become a world beater as a lyricist. His name was Johnny Mercer, who almost before he left Whiteman had written